barbecue, they were hanging out, they were doing what they do any typical evening. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. And can I say this? I think it's so important. Sometimes when you have these kinds of cases, you have this other side that goes, aha, he did something wrong, so therefore what? He deserves to be executed?
Sadiqa, I want to go back to a point that you made in Breonna Taylor's case, namely that the judge was granted a no-knock warrant. Can you explain what that is? Because it seems to have an inherent risk, namely that people whose houses are searched without a warrant are likely to respond with force, or could respond with force, especially in a country which is so heavily armed, that is a risk. So why did the judge grant, in this case, a no-knock warrant? And your response to this proposed Breonna's Law and groups like the ACLU wanting to ban no-knock warrants entirely?
Well, I think that, can you hear me?
We hear you perfectly.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I don't understand. There are certainly in situations where I can imagine if you have a kidnapping in process. But I think about the case in Cleveland where the man had several women locked in the basement for all of that time, all of those years. That's somewhere you're not going to knock there. But if you think that there are drugs in a home, you're going in at 1 o'clock in the morning.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
At KBOO, we think that all communities deserve to be fully informed on the policies and decisions that will impact their lives, and we need your help to make that happen. We're looking for citizen journalists to help collect, report, and broadcast the news. Do you think that there are groups that are underrepresented or marginalized by the mainstream media? Are you aware of social, political, or environmental activities that don't have adequate visibility? Are there important issues in your town or region that aren't getting coverage? This is your chance to give a voice to the voiceless. You don't have to have experience, and you don't have to come into KBOO's Portland studio. You can contribute from wherever you live. If you have some basic writing skills and a desire to get the word out, we want you. Just send an email with your idea and contact information to newsdirector, that's all one word, newsdirector@kboo.fm, and include the words citizen journalist in the subject line, and the news team will contact you. Once again, send that email to newsdirector@kboo.fm.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, historic protests in Oregon and calls for justice and change. Marchers in Washington remember a coworker who passed away from COVID-19 and how the epidemic made the richest even richer. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, June 4th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. A memorial service was held today in Minneapolis for George Floyd, whose death at the hands of a police officer a week ago has sparked protests across the country. The sanctuary at North Central University was full of Floyd's relatives and friends, along with political leaders, including Governor Tim Walz, Senators Amy Klobuchar and Tina Smith, and Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey. Civil rights leader the Reverend Jesse Jackson and celebrity figures Tiffany Haddish, Kevin Hart, and Chris Ludacris Bridges were also there. The service was broadcast live. People who spoke during the memorial included Reverend Al Sharpton, family members, the Floyd family lawyer, and the president of North Central University. Floyd's brothers, Philanice, Rodney, Terrence, and cousin Sherita Tate spoke of the man they knew as Perry, a person who had a gift for making people feel welcome, and shared memories of their time growing up together. Scott Hagen, president of North Central University, announced the school has created the George Floyd Memorial Scholarship and urged universities across the U.S. to create their own memorial scholarships as well. Reverend Sharpton delivered a eulogy to honor Floyd's life. He spoke about the deep-seated racism in the United States and said, quote, "What happened to Floyd happens every day in this country, in education, in health services, and in every area of American life. It is time for us to stand up in George's name and say, get your knee off our necks," end quote. Memorials for Floyd will also be held on Saturday in Rayford, North Carolina, and Monday in Houston, Texas. The killing of George Floyd has not only resulted in a week of protests in our community, the state, and the country, it's also provoking promises for change. KBOO's Annette Newell tells us about several developments, starting with a press conference by Portland city leaders this afternoon.
Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler extended his condolences to the family, friends, and many mourners across the country remembering George Floyd. He said he's committed to interrupt systems of institutional racism in Portland. He says one proposal is a plan he's presented to Police Chief Jamie Resch and talked to a team of school resource officers about. He says he is removing school resource officers from all schools in the district. Also, he promised to invest in the community, redirecting $1 million for communities to decide how to invest in a more positive experience for Black children. He says it's not a reflection on the police work in the schools and claims officers have built positive relationships based on mentoring. But he says this decision is based on what the community is now asking for. He praised City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty for her leadership on the issue. Wheeler also says he's joining other mayors across the country to sign a pledge offered by former President Barack Obama to review the Portland Police Bureau's use of force and make meaningful reforms. He says he will present the results from meetings with local Black leaders in the weeks to come. Wheeler accused President Donald Trump of abandoning America's ideals and allowing peaceful demonstrators to be attacked with rubber bullets because he wanted a photo op. He says Trump has not shown empathy during the crisis, and he says he felt a deep sense of gratitude when listening to President Obama, reminding us the United States was founded on protest, holding the status quo up to demand change, and he thanked Portlanders for demanding change. Also speaking this afternoon, Deputy Chief Chris Davis of the Portland Police, he said thousands of protesters, 8,000 of them, peacefully took to the streets last night, the sixth night in a row. But he says a small group of about 200 people broke windows, vandalized buildings, struck a security officer, and threw a full beer can at a Portland officer, striking his chin. He says 19 officers have been injured in the unrest so far, and they've arrested at least two people who they linked to criminal activity. Davis says the crowd dispersed at around 4 this morning. He said to the protesters, "I hear you. We have a lot of work to do to achieve our vision of a police bureau that you can be proud of and the community respects, with a promise of equal justice under law." The deputy chief thanked the tens of thousands of people who have come out for protests and said the actions of a few disruptors do not reflect on the vast majority. As for the families of the officers, he said, "I have not forgotten about you. We have not forgotten about you." Wednesday, during a virtual city council meeting, Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty had demanded the council vote to defund three police programs that she says are the most racially unequal systems in the Portland Police Bureau. She says she wants the city to scrap the Bureau's Gun Violence Reduction Team, PPB's contract with TriMet to serve as transit police officers, and the now-canceled School Resource Officer Program. Hardesty said, quote, "I want you to publicly affirm that you will work with me to make sure that we can remove the fear that police officers have of Black bodies, and the fear that Black bodies have against the police." Hardesty would need the support of at least two other city commissioners to include her proposals in the 2020-21 budget. The council plans a discussion and a vote on that on June 10th at 2 p.m. Meantime, a federal judge is allowing an excessive force lawsuit to continue against Portland police. This case concerns an August 2018 protest. Two protesters claim Portland police used excessive force against anti-fascist demonstrators while protecting Patriot Prayer members. Aaron Cantu and Tracy Molina claim the police fired flashbang grenades into a passive crowd while they were in downtown Portland counter-protesting against the right-wing group. Cantu suffered a brain injury. The two claim the city uses militarized force against left-wing protesters to punish them for their politics while not using that kind of force on right-wing protesters. Judge Stacey Beckerman said she found the plaintiffs have adequately alleged Portland police have a custom or practice of using excessive force at protests and that they used force with little provocation. The judge disagreed with the city's lawyers, who said that the plaintiffs could not prove excessive force. Finally, Governor Kate Brown ordered state flags lowered to half-staff today to honor George Floyd. She says state flags will be lowered from 11 this morning to sunset tonight. And she said, "We lower the Oregon flag to half-staff to recognize a profound loss of life, one that affects us all. As we mourn the loss of George Floyd, let us remember the many black lives that have been taken by unnecessary violence, and let us commit ourselves and our country to fundamental change." For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Annette Newell.
Portland City Commissioners are calling on police to change their tactics as a week of protests and unrest have taken over downtown city streets. Following Wednesday's council meeting, commissioners voiced outrage, criticizing the Portland Police Bureau's tactics in handling the protests. Commissioner Chloe Udaly said, quote, "I am absolutely horrified with what I saw last night. It is sadistic to use tear gas in the middle of a public health crisis that's attacking people's respiratory systems." Tuesday night's largely peaceful protests saw police deploying tear gas and other chemical agents at protesters for hours, escalating a small group that vandalized property and tried to block traffic late into the evening. Since Saturday, officers have targeted demonstrators with chemical agents and stun grenades, sometimes throwing them into large crowds. Commissioner Joanne Hardesty also voiced her condemnation of police tactics, calling the use of tear gas and flashbang grenades, quote, "completely unacceptable." Hardesty later tweeted the need to change the culture and system of policing, citing the demilitarization of police as a step in that direction. Wednesday, Police Chief Jamie Resch said incident commanders are the ones who can make the call to deploy tear gas. Resch said, quote, "A group of individuals broke away from the peaceful protests. The PPB did not instigate the violence that began in our city last night." Portland Public Schools Superintendent Guadalupe Guerrero announced Thursday he is discontinuing the regular presence of school resource officers at Portland schools. Guerrero's announcement on Twitter said, quote, "The time is now. With new proposed investments in direct student supporters, social workers, counselors, culturally specific partnerships, and more, I am discontinuing the regular presence of school resource officers. We need to re-examine our relationship with the PPB," end quote. In December 2018, Portland Public Schools had reached an agreement with the City of Portland to pay more than $1 million annually for 9 police officers to patrol district schools. However, after facing resistance from students, the district decided to pause the contract. In January 2019, the Portland School Board voted to suspend its agreement to pay for armed school resource officers in its schools. School resource officers currently patrol schools part-time, but they're paid by the police bureau. Portland Police Association President Daryl Turner told OPB today that patrol officers will still respond to calls on district campuses regardless of what happens with the program. The COVID-19 pandemic actually made some of the super rich even richer. The wealth of America's billionaires increased nearly 10% over just 3 weeks as the COVID crisis took hold, according to the Institute for Policy Studies. Roz Brown has more on that story.
A former U.S. Labor Secretary says the $2 trillion CARES Act to address the coronavirus pandemic provided American workers with stimulus checks and extra unemployment payments, but those who benefited most were large corporations, banks, and the wealthy. Robert Reich served under President Bill Clinton and says those who needed funds the least have gained the most through bailout funds, numerous tax credits, and deductions. According to Reich, America's billionaires are at least $100 billion richer than they were at the start of the pandemic.
And so you have a picture in which power continues to play a huge role in who gets what, because wealth generates power and power generates more wealth. That's the vicious cycle we are in.
About 108 million Americans have died from COVID-19, and more than 40 million are jobless. At the same time, rent eviction moratoriums will soon end in half of the states, and extra unemployment benefits are set to expire at the end of July. Reich says the pandemic has shown how vulnerable most Americans are, with more than 9 million people having lost employer-provided health care in the past few months.
If there was ever a reason for Medicare for all, we can see it now. If there was ever a justification for universal basic income, we can see it now. But these kinds of ideas have been fought tooth and nail.
Reich argues American democracy has become an oligarchy, with a small group of people in control who maintain their power by pitting citizens against each other.
Stoking racism or xenophobia or stoking and fueling a kind of anger between the left and the right, the so-called left and right.
Reich believes the pandemic has revealed the class structure in America more vividly than anything we've seen since the 2008 Great Recession, when Wall Street received bailouts, but homeowners did not, which cost many their homes, savings, and jobs. For Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic Violence. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 8, we'll hear Ear to the Streets of Portland. Tonight's weather is mostly cloudy, down to a low of 56. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with a slight chance of a rain shower and a high near 70 degrees. Today in history, on this date in 1989, Chinese troops stormed through Tiananmen Square in Beijing, killing and arresting thousands of pro-democracy protesters. The quote of the day is from the novelist Ma Zhan, who was among the freedom protesters. They said, quote, "Every person in the crowd was a victim of the massacre." The 2020 census, delayed because of the new coronavirus, is ramping back up to provide an accurate count. So, among other things, states can redraw districts for 2021 and 2022. Plus, national figures across the country decry President Trump's response to the protests. With more on these stories, here's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
The data has to be reliable. Without reliable data, it doesn't matter how good the redistricting process is, you're not going to produce good maps.
Every 10 years, states redraw the districts from which their representatives are elected to state legislatures and Congress based on new census numbers. When partisan mapmakers draw districts favoring one party over the other or to benefit incumbents, it's called gerrymandering. Democracy reformers like lawyer Yuri Shrudensky with the Brennan Center for Justice are working to reduce gerrymandering. But before anyone can begin creating nonpartisan and fair maps, they need the data.
This is a case where I hope politics, and I know this is wishful thinking, takes a backseat and people in positions of power work collaboratively to ensure the integrity of this all-important undertaking.
The Census Bureau was already scrambling to catch up to their schedule even before the pandemic put a hold on their outreach.
Let's remember that, first of all, the process was delayed because the president wanted to add a citizenship question to the census. That had to go all the way to the Supreme Court. So some of the planning and printing and getting things together for the census was already delayed.
Professor Theodore Arrington from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, says it's going to be tough for states who have elections in 2021 if the reports are delayed until late July, the Census Bureau's new proposed deadline. While both parties have benefited from gerrymandering, the current advantage is widely considered to be in Republican hands. The Supreme Court did block the citizenship question, but many undocumented immigrants and people living in mixed-status households are still wary. Without an accurate count, communities may not get all the resources they need. CEO of the League of United Latin American Citizens, Cindy Benavides, explains.
We're living in a time when there is politics involved and our community is trying to be erased. You know, we're living in a time when we have to forcefully step up and make sure that we are being proactive in filling out that census form.
The Census Bureau is ramping back up. Michael Cook is chief of the Bureau's Public Information Office.
In all of the operations that we're conducting, all of the staff that we're bringing back, we have a rigorous virtual training on COVID-19 to ensure that they follow all of the social distancing protocols.
Across the nation, national figures are coming out to condemn President Trump's response to protests, including evangelical leader Pat Robertson, Pope Francis, former presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama. Former Defense Secretary Jim Mattis accused the president of deliberately sowing discord, referring to Trump, he told The Atlantic, "We can unite without him." More journalists have been under attack as well. Wednesday, paramilitary forces without visible identification, reported to be from the Bureau of Prisons, appeared in Washington, D.C., raising major concerns about accountability and the possibility that civilians could wear tactical gear and appear to be law enforcement. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
A new report shows protecting workers is the key to phasing out dependence on fossil fuels. As Eric Galatis reports, key elements for phasing out fossil fuels in a managed way include social protections for fossil fuel workers, sound investments in low-emission sectors, and local economic diversification.
As Wyoming's oil and gas sector continues to struggle during the coronavirus pandemic, a new report outlines how lawmakers can diversify revenue streams and begin phasing out reliance on fossil fuels. Report co-author Shivan Kartha says phasing out fossil fuels is necessary across the globe to prevent the worst impacts of climate change, but it doesn't have to be chaotic. And he says oil, gas, and coal workers should be at the center of transitioning to a clean energy economy.
We have to put workers first. We have to do this in a way that creates a better future for them. Better jobs, safer jobs, jobs that keep them healthier, jobs that provide good wages and good benefits and health care.
Kartha says in wealthy nations such as America, the burden of switching to cleaner energy does not have to rest solely on the shoulders of oil and gas producing states like Wyoming. While many nations are developing plans to reduce fossil fuel use, the U.S. is currently going in the opposite direction, prioritizing extraction industries in order to achieve a policy of energy dominance. The report's recommendations include developing cooperative strategies so that states such as Wyoming and nations such as the Congo get help diversifying their economies to create new revenue streams. Kartha contends the recent global drop in demand shows that being a net oil and gas exporter made the U.S. economy more vulnerable during the health emergency.
As we just saw, when the global oil markets were, you know, spinning all over the place, when those prices went down, when they went down globally, that very strongly affected workers here.
The report says wealthy countries need to take the lead in managing the phase out. Otherwise, poorer oil-dependent nations won't join what must truly be a global effort. According to the world's leading climate scientists, just a decade remains to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to safe levels. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Galatis.
President Trump signed an executive order today that instructs agencies to waive environmental laws in order to speed up federal approval for new mines, highways, pipelines, and other projects due to the economic emergency, according to the Washington Post. KBOO's Melissa Hood has the latest.
Declaring an economic emergency allows the president to invoke a section of federal law that allows actions to be taken that will cause environmental harm and disregards normal laws that require agencies to allow public input on proposed projects and allow analysis regarding potential environmental harm. A senior administration official said today that signing the order would help the nation's economy recover from losses due to COVID-19 by, quote, expediting construction of highways and other projects designed for environmental, energy, transportation, natural resource, and other uses. The order will also facilitate civil works projects overseen by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and allow the Interior, Agriculture, and Defense Departments to use their power to speed up projects on federal lands, according to the Washington Post. AXPC Chief Executive Ann Bradbury praised the administration's decisions and said, quote, removing bureaucratic barriers that stifle economic growth is paramount to getting American energy workers back in their jobs and spurring business investment that gets our economy moving again. Thomas Jensen, a partner at the firm Perkins Coie, noted that the order is a threat to the National Environmental Policy Act, which was enacted 50 years ago partly to prevent arbitrary federal decisions on projects that threaten communities and the environment. He said the administration cannot set aside laws that protect vulnerable Americans or the environment, and decisions made in response to the new executive order could be challenged in court. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Melissa Hood.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has declared a state of emergency after a massive oil spill in Siberia. A ruptured fuel tank at a power plant near the town of Norilsk leaked more than 20,000 tons of oil into the Amburnaya River in north-central Russia, just above the Arctic Circle. The accident happened on May 29th. power station employees failed to report the spill to emergency services for 2 days, with hopes of containing the fuel. Infuriated by the company's slow response to notify officials, Putin declared the state of emergency Wednesday. He lambasted the efforts, saying, quote, "Why did government agencies only find out about this 2 days after the fact? Are we going to learn about emergency situations from social media?" Environmental groups are calling the damage catastrophic, with large swaths of the river tainted by an ominous crimson as it ekes its way to the ocean. Initial findings report the concentration of contaminants surrounding the water to be tens of thousands of times over safe levels. Due to the area's remote location and the river's shallow water, cleanup efforts are slow-going and difficult. Norilsk Nickel, the corporation that owns the fuel plant, has cited thawing permafrost as the culprit in the collapse and rupturing of the tank, highlighting the threat that global warming poses to Arctic infrastructure and ecosystems. The Russian Investigative Committee has opened a criminal inquiry on the matter and detained the plant's manager. This accident is one of the biggest oil spills in modern Russian history, with Greenpeace Russia comparing the enormous discharge to the Exxon Valdez tanker spill in Alaska in 1989. Environmental racism and policy brutality can become intertwined issues. As Eric Tegedoff reports, now Washington has created a new map that breaks down racial health disparities due to environmental conditions.
Environmental groups are joining the chorus of voices denouncing police brutality in the wake of George Floyd's death. Some see environmental harm and police violence aimed at communities of color as inseparable issues. Research finds communities of color and under-resourced communities are more likely to be located near hazardous waste sites and subjected to pollution. Reverend Dr. Herbert Carey at To God Be the Glory House of Worship in Kent says these same communities also are subject to harsher treatment by the criminal justice system.
Environmental justice and police brutality are moral issues of violence, and it is in the poor and underprivileged area that all of this takes place.
Carey says environmental hazards create health disparities for communities of color. People of color are more likely to suffer from asthma, low birth weights, and other effects associated with environmental risk factors. Susan Balbus is board president of the environmental justice group Front and Centered in Washington State. She says one issue hangs over both environmental racism and police brutality.
They're all connected to white supremacy and institutional racism, which is built into our system.
Balbus says policy change and more resources are needed to help correct some of these disparities. Washington State has created a map of health disparities that she says will be instrumental in guiding changes going forward. But she also notes the voices of people of color often aren't heard in discussions about policy.
It's getting leaders from communities of color at the decision-making table. And then that's how we begin to shift. We shift the narrative, we shift the understanding, and we shift policy, and we shift resource allocation.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, June 4th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade and Melissa Hood. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, Eric Gladys, and Roz Brown. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our listeners. If you would like to support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm, or you can use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. We'll be right back. Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence is a nonprofit group devoted to promoting equity and social change in order to end violence in all communities. The coalition organizes a multitude of local member organizations that do direct action work with those impacted by domestic and sexual violence. Supporting survivors of domestic and sexual violence has an added challenge thanks to the socially distanced world of coronavirus. Indeed, several cities in Oregon have seen spikes in their number of domestic violence or DV-related calls. I spoke with Renee Kim, the Equity and Access Coordinator for the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, to learn more about how the coalition's work has changed during the pandemic, the opportunities for growth exposed by coronavirus, and radical self-care. So, you work as the Equity and Access Coordinator for the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Can you tell me a little bit about what your work looked like outside of the pandemic context?
Yes. So the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence is an organization that provides technical assistance and support to all of our statewide domestic violence and sexual assault programs. We conduct a ton of training. We have an annual conference, and we also do specific roundtables and webinars for our member programs and community partners. We also convene numerous caucuses and work groups, and we also work with policymakers doing legislative work and support for survivors' needs around the state.
And so how is that work, either, you know, specifically what you do or with the organizations that you work with, how has that work changed due to COVID-19?
It has changed dramatically because our work is so much in person and with community. And so the first thing that has really changed is we're working remotely, and we are doing a ton of phone calls as well as Zoom and different platforms to reach out to programs. I think that the biggest challenges for domestic violence programs and domestic violence survivors during COVID has been the isolation piece. When you are a survivor of domestic violence, oftentimes you are isolated anyway, away from family and friends and community networks. So sheltering in place and COVID has just compounded that. And I think that the messaging and communities, domestic violence, sexual assault agencies, is really important that they are still open. All of the programs that we support are still open across the state. And there have been a lot of different federal funds that have come down the pipeline to help programs during COVID with cell phones, laptops for advocates that are working with survivors. And some of the more rural programs around the state have continued some in-person services, but it's really changed. It's not walk-in. You have to make appointments. And then the social distancing guidelines as well.
So, you know, looking at the way that you would work to combat domestic violence pre-pandemic and post-pandemic, do you see, like, major differences there? I guess I'm just curious about those differences.
Yeah, I think that as far as combating domestic violence pre and within the COVID realm now, really hasn't changed because all of the programs are still continuing to operate their 24-hour hotlines. There are programs, like I said, all over the state that continue to do support groups as well. Even though they may have been canceled in person, they are still able to do this online and meet with folks through different ways. And I think that the messaging around DV is still that, you know, we are here for you and we are here to advocate for you and to keep you safe.
Yeah, I know for a lot of different, for different advocacy groups, pandemic restrictions have exposed holes in the way that we treat certain issues, and, you know, as such, because like you said, a lot of it is grounded in person. You go to this place and you get help in this way, and not being able to do that has kind of exposed the holes and how that doesn't work for everybody, and also offered, you know, an opportunity to for growth and for new thinking. Do you see that the pandemic has offered new opportunities in your work?
I definitely have seen that. And one of the things that you mentioned, it just struck me. I was doing notes for this, but, you know, I don't really pay attention to my notes. I just start talking off the top of my head. So one of the things I was thinking about when you were asking this question is that it has brought to light many different things in the fight for social justice, especially around domestic violence, sexual assault work, and really understanding that, you know, many communities, especially marginalized communities, communities of color, queer and trans communities, non-English speaking communities, don't access domestic violence and sexual assault services the way that mainstream dominant culture white people access it. So it is very different. And I think that's really important to think about and reflect on, and think about how we may want to change things. So I lead several work groups for the coalition. One is the Communities of Color Task Force, the other is the People of Color Caucus. And I feel like the light that, the other light that has really been shed is that, you know, all of the advocates, so we support advocates who are supporting survivors. So many of the advocates that work with survivors are now, they're at home as well. So they're teaching their kids, they've got their pets and partners and everything else is happening. And so they are really having to shift how they deliver services and how they do their work. And a lot of folks that enter this work also have some kind of trauma history. Not everybody does, but a lot of people do. And so when you think about everything that's going on in this world right now, it's bringing forth a lot of layers of what I call collective trauma. And so I've been reflecting a lot about how are the advocates doing? What kind of support do they need? How can we support them? We just recently at our office, we had a webinar on radical self-care. And I think that this is something that we definitely need to incorporate and teach ourselves and our advocates as well, so that it moves out into the community. I think that's really an important piece. I think people forget that people that do this work, they too also feel a lot of trauma when they're doing this work. And so having a trauma-informed lens and a practice of care is really important.
Can you tell me a little bit about what radical self-care looks like?
Yeah. Radical self-care to me looks like, it does not look like going to a spa or having food that's really small that you can't pronounce. It, to me, it's more about really taking time to reflect and step back from the work that you know is starting to bring you down. If you feel like you can't catch your breath, or you feel like you aren't really listening or fully present for people that are talking to you, or maybe you're feeling more agitated, that's the time when you do that radical self-care, when you step back and you decide, you know what, I'm going to have a big plate of pasta tonight. I'm going to watch a movie where I don't have to think, or I'm just going to go take a nap. You know, just things that kind of recharge you and rejuvenate you, so that you can offer that same spirit of care to the people that you're working with.
Thank you for that. What do you find is most commonly misunderstood about domestic violence or DV, and how, you know, we work to prevent it?
That is such a good question, and there's so many ways to answer that. I think some of the most commonly misunderstood things about domestic violence is that it is, you know, using air quotes, it's those people who are in those kinds of relationships. A lot of people think that people don't want to leave those relationships, or that they actually get like a rush from it, or it's exciting, or that these folks aren't smart, or they don't care about their kids, or they're drug addicts, or whatever. You know, the list goes on and on. And these things, I believe, are furthest from the truth, because domestic violence impacts everyone. Every one of us knows somebody who has been impacted or affected by domestic violence, and it crosses all race, ethnicity, income. And I believe strongly that prevention comes through education and the coalition. We definitely support the programs across the state to provide prevention in the schools and in their communities.
So to that end, what would you say is most important for people to learn about DV and the struggle against it?
I would say that the most important thing to learn is that it truly can happen to any one of us. And again, I'll reiterate that all of us know someone, even if we think we don't know anyone, that has been touched by domestic violence in their life. I think that the other really tough struggle is that domestic violence sexual assault programs for forever have really struggled to have stable funding, and they almost rely solely on government funding. So donations and foundation grants mean so much to agencies across the state, so that's really important.
Renee, do you have any closing thoughts? Anything we didn't cover before we wrap up?
Well, I have a closing thought. I really hope that with everything that's happening in the world right now, with the protests and with COVID and everything that's happening, that we are able to not forget that people really matter, and that survivors of domestic violence are really oftentimes very afraid and in some ways even ashamed to come forward or to talk to someone. And it's not their fault. I think our culture and our society lays a lot of victim blaming on people. And I really hope that, that the things that are happening now is really, it's gonna shift how we think and how we respect and care for people in this world. So those are my thoughts for today.
Yeah, that's a great sentiment. If our listeners are interested in getting involved in supporting the Coalition Against Domestic Violence or learning more about it, what's the best way for them to do that?
One of the best ways is to contact your local domestic violence sexual assault agency in your area, in your town. And there's a list on our website. If you go to OCADSV.org and you click on there, and you can find a map of all the programs throughout the state. And each program has a volunteer coordinator and program that you can talk with and learn how to get involved with your local DV agency.
Very cool. Well, Renee, thank you so much for speaking with us today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Althea. I appreciate it.
That was Renee Kim, the Equity and Access Coordinator for the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. More information about the coalition and a directory of resources in your area available online at ocadsv.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
The last 6 evenings in Portland have been marked by a surreal feeling of both solidarity and disconnect. Most parts of the city are quiet, with many people sheltering in place to try to prevent the spread of the pandemic. But each evening, as one approaches downtown, there is a roar, the roar of a crowd that has swelled larger and larger each night. Yesterday, Wednesday evening in Portland, tens of thousands of protesters took to the street for the 6th night in a row to call for an end to police violence and racism toward black people in this country. All of the protesters, at least that I saw, wore masks and tried to protect themselves, but could not stay silent. Police set up chain-link fences across several streets in downtown Portland to prevent people from marching to the Justice Center where prisoners are housed. After protesters managed to break into the Justice Center on Friday night, police feared they would return and try to free the hundreds of people imprisoned there. Here are some of the speakers from last night's rally in Waterfront Park.
There was a time before police. There's going to be a time after police. We're going to envision it. We're going to practice restorative justice. We're going to have safety without fear, without violence. We are going to fund black futures. We are not going to pay $400 million a year for black displacement. We are not going to pay for black disenfranchisement.
Right.
We are not going to pay for black debt. We're going to resource black futures. We have 3 demands. We need your support. We need your voices. Number 1, we must defund the police.
Yes. That's
right now. In 1 week from today, we want our city council committing $50 million out of the budget this year.
Yes.
We're moving to 0. Cut it down now. Number 2, we want all of that money reinvested into our community's future. We are in the midst of a devastating crisis. Health, social, and economic. Its impacts are on black people, indigenous people, immigrants and refugees, brown folks in our community. We're on the front lines, essential workers, dying, being evicted, houseless, being swept. We need community-led health and safety strategies. We need our people to get housed. We need our people to stay housed. We have to have our basic needs resourced now. And not now, but right now. In 1968, there's not a decade that our police department has not been under investigation, under settlement order, or under consent decree by the U.S. Department of Justice. They've always been this way. Profiling, rights violation, murder against black people, against people with disabilities, against people in mental health crisis. They profile, they lie about it with distorted statistics.
Do you think we're doing nothing? Do you think we're doing nothing?
No!
Yeah, we're being peaceful, but we're being loud. We are being loud as hell. Don't forget that. We're not being passive right now. We're not being passive. There's a difference. I need those of you who are able to do so to have my back. We are here together. They are there protesting the way they need to protest. Riots are the result of those who are silenced who need to take action. They are taking action the way they need to take. And that's okay. That's perfectly fine. And we need to still be able to support them. We are peaceful. That doesn't mean we can't support them though, that we can't aid them and help them out. Help pull them when they are hurt and injured. Because they're doing the same exact thing we're doing. They're trying to make change. All right? You got our back? You got my back?
Yeah.
Thank you. I just need those who are ready to stay ready. Now, we don't got to get violent. Like I said last night, be 100% peaceful, 0% victim. Right? I'm nobody's victim. We're ready for a smoke. But we don't, listen, we're here to peacefully protest and deliver this message, and we don't have to be here as long as we're going to have to be here. We're watching y'all, all right? Front lines. If you see children, get them the f*** out of there. The cops don't care. Especially if it's a black kid. I don't know if you noticed. They don't care. They have their own agenda. They're laughing behind our backs. We've heard it on the scanners. Understand this. It's a peaceful protest, but I really don't want to have a conversation with them. I want them gone. I want them gone. I bet. They're putting more money into the military than they are into our children. How does that make any sense? Where's the enemy? I don't see any enemy. All I see are my fellow patrons. So let's just remember, we are what makes this city great. We are what gives them power. We are their backbone. They are nothing without us. They will have you think. They will have you think that you're weak and they are strong. They got some grenades. They got all the, but we are the people. What are they without us? It feels like the whole city's here right now. It feels like the whole city's here right now. It feels like the entire city's here right now. Beautiful day to cause some mayhem. Beautiful day to disrupt some. I thank you guys so much for being here. If you are black, from the bottom of my heart, thank you for giving a f- for so much of my life. I've seen people turn the other way and ignore my plight. I've never felt like anybody ever understood me. I've never felt like there was anybody in this city that looked like me, that felt like me, that lived like me. They done broke us up. You remember when Portland used to be black?
Right.
The neighborhood I grew up in had more black families than not. I'm the last black family in my neighborhood.
Right.
But in respect for all of you that are here, I ain't going nowhere.
Right.
That's my house. You can't buy my house. Go somewhere. Build Concordia somewhere else. I don't care. Today is about peaceful change. It's about progress. And progress does not come easily. It's going to take time. We're here for the long road. It's not a short game. This is war. Make no mistakes, this is war. Make no mistakes, this is war. So in the spirit of that, I want to remind you guys, know your enemy.
Right.
There is nobody, no organization more sneaky than your government. There's nobody, there's no organization in this goddamn world more sneaky than your government. Guess what? The government controls the narrative. When have they ever labeled the KKK a terrorist organization? Oh, they are the KKK. They are the KKK. It just feels like people are tired, man. It's never been like this in this city. It's never been like this in this country, at least not while I've been alive. We've had protests in this city before. It never looked like this.
Right.
Before and after pictures, nuts. It looks like the Trump inauguration versus Obama's. And I think that's beautiful. A little ironic, too. So while he's in his bunker, we're out here in these streets, occupying, disrupting, letting our voices be heard, letting them know, we see you. Can everybody say, we see you?
We see you.
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 We're going to have Reverend Edie Mondenake come up and talk to you, the president of the Portland chapter of the NAACP.
2 weeks ago, I didn't think I would be here. Yep. I certainly couldn't predict that I would have been in this place 2 weeks ago, but I'm grateful. I'm honored that you are letting me talk slightly more to the mic. All right, I'll work on it. All right. All right, all right. As I was saying, 2 weeks ago, I didn't think I'd be here in front of you, but I'm grateful for the opportunity to be in front of you. Honored and grateful, because this is a peaceful protest, and I'm glad to be part of that.
Actually, the last time I was in this park with this many people, believe it or not, it's true, was 2008 when Obama was right over there. Yep. Talking to Portland before he was president for the first time.
He packed it out, sure
did. That was a good moment for me. I had my kids, I was glad to be here, and what you're doing tonight is at least as important. You're fighting for the same thing. I've been alive a while. I was in Los Angeles during the Watts riots. I was in Los Angeles watching the 1968 Olympics with my father when the two young men held their fist up in the air, Tommy Smith and Juan Giancarlo. I was at an HBCU, Howard, in Washington, D.C. I marched in the March on Washington, the second March on Washington, in 1983.
Right.
I marched in the Bakke decision in 1970s, and all that time, I thought the marching was over, but here we are tonight, and you all are marching again, and it's basically marching for the same thing over
right.
and over and over again. And I'm glad I live to see this march, but I'm hoping this is the last march I have to see
right.
where we're marching for this thing again. Be unapologetic about telling your story to those who need to hear it. Some of the stories need to be told in our own households. Tell that story. Tell it. I've been asked in the last couple of weeks, last week and a half, what can I do? What can I do? What can I do? I can't tell you how many black men that I know that have been asked that question about what can we do? How can we be helping? And that's the allies. That's everybody. And, you know, start where you are. If you're at work and there's no black people in your office, work with the people that are there and raise the same conversations, have the same difficult conversations, have the same issues come up. Talk about it. Support your community-based organizations that are out there doing the work for you. They know the community. They work with the community. Support them. You know, and you can help us end these, what is it now, 401 years of oppression of the black man in America. You know, we're not alone. You're our allies, but we have to have these conversations. I'll just wind up by saying, like Pastor Mondaneng, I'm George Floyd. I'm Michael Fesser. I'm my son. You know, these people are us. You are them, we are them. So let's wind up by just telling the truth. 2017 wasn't the largest inauguration. Kids in cages are a bad, bad thing. The police should be treated the same as every one of us. Follow the same rules. They're citizens just like us. Black men shouldn't be killed for being black men. And Portland and America, we must work to change these systems of oppression, disparity, unfairness, and injustice. And if we do that, we'll be all right. But we just have to start today.
Right.
Thank you.
Those were the voices of people speaking in downtown Portland last night at a protest against police brutality and racism. People are gathering at 6 p.m. Revolution Hall, Southeast 13th and Stark, to march to downtown to once again confront the scourge of racism in our society. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Jenka Soderberg. Thank you. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
You're listening to Rose City Native Radio, Low Res Edition.